Hello again. Greetings. This is Christopher Bolin, and this is The Bolin Show. It's Friday, November 9th, and I'm putting together this audio file, this third program, for the benefit of my listeners on my website, www.bolin.com. It's a beautiful Friday afternoon, and I'm here with Helya Koskell, my wife.
Hello.
And we have a lot to discuss today, so we'll move pretty quickly. First, there's some news. News from Chicago is that Linda Shelton, Dr. Linda Shelton, who was is a big supporter of mine in Chicago and an expert in medicine. She's a doctor and also an expert in law, has been jailed by the Cook County Sheriff. She's been frequently jailed. She is a fighter of corruption. And like the other people in the Pro Se Club in Chicago who helped me in my legal problems there, they are trying to fight a very powerful dragon, and that is the corruption of Chicago and Cook County. And we have some email that's come to us lately that Linda Shelton has been incarcerated again in the Cook County Jail. And this resulted because she went to a preliminary hearing, if I understand this right, Helya. She had some medical equipment with her.
And they didn't allow her to take this medical equipment with her.
Right. And this happened at the doorway, at the security point where she was entering the courtroom. Now, I want to... many of you have not probably been to a Cook County courtroom.
Or in any courtroom in America.
Well, the Cook County courtroom is special. I went to Cook County court several times this year, in trying to defend my innocence against these trumped up charges that I faced as a result of the police assault that happened at my house. And you recall, it was very odd when you enter the Cook County courthouse, you have to pass through security checkpoint, very much like going on an airline, at an airport check-in. Except that the personnel at the Cook County courtroom check-in are, how would you describe them?
Well, first, men go right and women go left. Mm-hmm. I think that's very peculiar too. So there are women guards and male guards because.
Right.
You practically have to do a striptease number there. They want you to take off your shoes and belts and everything which is hanging. So,
and everything comes out of your pockets.
And then they have these strange comments as well, and they're extremely unfriendly. So if you dare to say anything as
right.
a response, you may wind up in deep trouble.
Well, the feeling that I've always gotten there is that they're very haughty, very arrogant, and that there is no bounds to their power. And that's because it's the Cook County Sheriff who they work for, and there is no system of checks and balances. There's no way that a citizen can complain and say, "This, you're not treating people right." I have seen them. One of the ladies going into the courtroom one day was an Oriental woman. She didn't speak English very well. You know, people that are even processed here for tickets and all kinds of minor things.
In America, you have to go to the courthouse for every traffic ticket you get.
And there are hundreds of people lined up. You know, sometimes there's 100 people lined up there. And the female guards or whatever they were, the security guards there work for the Cook County Sheriff, they were screaming at this woman because she didn't understand their English commands and wasn't, you know, responding quickly enough or properly enough. I've never seen anything like that. I've never seen such unbridled arrogance in a courtroom or in a courthouse. And what people have to understand is that Chicago and Cook County, the apparatus there, is extremely corrupt. In the last election, I think about 4 years ago, there was a white man running for the presidency there. I forgot his name. He had a nice wife. And he was fighting corruption as well. He was running against Mr. Stroger, the black man who was the former president. And what happened, if I remember correctly, is that Mr. Stroger died or was very ill before the election. And the nearly dead black candidate, Mr. Stroger, beat the white candidate who was running on an anti-corruption platform. And if my listeners have read my material on Chicago voting and electronic voting machines, they'll understand how that corruption got into place. But our prayers are with Linda Shelton, who is now incarcerated in the Cook County.
Only because she wanted to bring a piece of equipment that she had commonly brought with her into the court building.
Yeah.
Because she couldn't bring it with her. And when they said no, she had protested. And then the sheriff just arrested her.
Right.
Because saying that she had caused disturbance to the peace.
Right.
Well, if her life depends on that equipment, it's quite natural that you have to take it with you.
Exactly.
And now she has to rot in jail until her next court date comes up.
Right.
And she has been arrested with no bond.
Right.
So we will be posting some information about this on our website.
And how our listeners might contact Linda Shelton or aid her in her plight.
Or even maybe send her some money.
Yeah.
We'll put all that information on our website, www.bolena.com.
And I think that people might be interested in reading. Linda Shelton is a legal expert who attended the last two days of my trial last June. And she's written about it. She's a legal expert. And what she does is she irritates the Cook County machine because she, protests and points out their arrogance and their corruption. And they don't like that.
First of all, she is no longer practicing medicine. And like those pro se people in Chicago said that some of them have to work full time to keep themselves out of jail.
Right.
So once you've gotten in trouble with some trumped up charges, these things just pile up and there's no way you can fight it.
Right.
You can fight it, but it's really an uphill battle.
Right. You know, that's what I saw, that I could have stayed in Chicago and tried to fight these charges, but I could have done that for the rest of my life. And I have a family, and I have bigger fish to fry than the corruption in Chicago. But Linda Shelton, my hat goes off to her. She's a big supporter of mine and an expert in legal defense. So we'll put that information on the website as soon as possible. There's some other news that's percolating that I really want to touch. I don't watch TV very much, but I did look at the BBC news yesterday, and I saw the images coming from Georgia in the Caucasus, the Georgia in Central Europe or in Central Asia almost. The Georgian crisis where Mikhail Saakashvili, the American nominated appointed president, the graduate of Columbia University, thousands of people are in the streets of Tbilisi demanding that the president resign. Some of them want him to be arrested. And is that called the Velvet Revolution? What was the revolution in Georgia called? I think it was the Velvet Revolution or something like that. In any case, that revolution is no longer quite so soft. And the Georgian people are standing up against the corruption. That's the main problem, is that they say that the Saakashvili regime has not done anything about corruption or poverty. Helia, you've been to Georgia, haven't you? Tbilisi?
Yes, I have.
And how would you describe the Georgian people and their patriotism?
Well, they're very proud people,
mm-hmm.
and very emotional, and they're very nationalistic.
They're Christian people.
Yes, so they're Christian.
Orthodox Christians.
Yeah, I once worked in the entertainment business. I was a costume designer for a rock band, and at one concert hall, we were giving a concert together with a big dance troupe.
Mm-hmm. From Georgia.
And because I think it was in Tashkent, and the snow came down, and we were like, we got stuck there for 3 days and mm-hmm. nights. And then we spent some time together in the hotel with these people, and they were beautiful, beautiful. The women were blue-eyed, very light skin, very, very beautiful
and tall,
women. And tall, yes, and very
mm-hmm.
proud.
Mm-hmm.
So
so the Georgians are a proud and an old nation.
Yes.
Stalin was part Georgian? Well, he came from that part of the world. Some people say he was part Jewish or something. But in any case, the Georgians are very proud people, and they are fed up with the American-imposed regime.
At least supported,
yeah,
you know.
that was supported by the United States. Mm-hmm. And the other crisis, of course, is Pakistan. Pakistan is at a breaking point as well. And that's probably of even greater importance to the West, because Pakistan is, of course, a nuclear-armed country. And the forces that are opposed to Mr. Musharraf, General Musharraf, are, of course, largely Islamic forces, Islamic groups who are opposed to his corruption and his acting as a lackey for the West, for the United States. And the third crisis that is really hitting the front pages is the dollar crisis. The dollar is now about 1 euro costs about a dollar and a half. Now, 5 years ago, when I was in Europe, a dollar bought you about €1 and 12 or 15 cents. And now it's the other way around with a vengeance. The dollar is really falling. So that for Americans to go to Europe now or to buy European products, they're about twice as expensive as they were 5 years ago. And on the other hand, Europeans and people who have euros and gold-backed currency are finding that property in the United States is very cheap. So how did we get into that crisis? How did the dollar plummet so radically? This is a pretty obvious. I mean, the Bush administration, who has been in charge the entire time of this declining dollar, is spending money on illegal wars like there's no tomorrow, and you know, building no infrastructure. This is the same president who won't spend a nickel for passenger rail service in the United States, but they're spending billions of dollars every week for illegal wars and adventures in Central Asia and the Middle East. Now, the other thing is that on the BBC, I don't usually watch it, but I saw that on Hard Talk yesterday, which is one of the best journalism shows on television. It's a half-hour program on the BBC where they debate. They have a real old-fashioned debate. And the host was Stephen Sakur, and he was talking to Stephen Walt, the author of the book about the Israeli lobby from the Walt and Mearsheimer report. I haven't read Mr. Walt's book, but I'm familiar with the Israeli lobby, and I would like to read his book. But I did see that Stephen Sakur, the BBC host, was very antagonistic to the thesis that the Israeli lobby has unbridled power and a stranglehold on the U.S. Congress and U.S. Middle Eastern policy. He objected to the use of Mr. Walt's use of the word in his first article, that the Israeli lobby had a stranglehold. And he asked Mr. Walt if he would, why he had used that word and why he had not used that word in the book. He had taken that word out of the book and used a different word. Mr. Walt was backpedaled a little bit too much on that, because anybody who knows the history of the Israeli lobby and U.S. politics knows that that's exactly what the Israeli lobby has on the U.S. Congress. It's a stranglehold. That if you've read They Dare to Speak Out, the book about the number, dozens of U.S. politicians, senior politicians, people like Charles Percy and Adlai Stevenson, people who in the past, in their political careers, questioned or challenged Israeli policies coming through Washington, and they were rejected. They were defeated in the next election due to the power of the Israeli lobby. So the Israeli lobby does have a real stranglehold. That is to say that if a politician in the U.S. Congress does not go along with Israeli policy as dictated by AIPAC, they will be strangled literally, and they will be defeated in the coming election. They know that. And that's why we have such an amen crowd in Congress. I saw that French President Sarkozy was speaking and talking about how France could not accept a nuclear Iran with nuclear power, not nuclear weapons, but nuclear power. And the entire U.S. Congress, I think, got up on their hands and knees, got up on their feet and were applauding the statement by the French president. It's pretty outrageous. But then in this interview with Mr. Walt, the author of the Israeli Lobby book, Mr. Walt said that in defending his thesis in his book, he said that there are 75 journalists in the United States who are reflexive supporters of Israel. That is that they will defend Israel, Israeli policy, Israeli actions, come hell or high water. That's what they're doing. And on the other hand, there are only about four or five, he said, in the United States mainstream media who challenge Israeli policies. So he said there is no dialogue. Stephen Socker from BBC was trying to say that there's a dialogue. There's debate in the U.S. media over Israel and Israeli policy. And there isn't. There never has been. It is, as Mr. Walt said, a monologue. And that's very important because that's getting to what I'm writing about and what I'm going to discuss today, is that the Israeli control, Zionist control of the media and Israeli control of the U.S. Congress has rendered the United States the most Zionist and propagandized. The Americans are the most propagandized public in the world regarding the Israeli question. You know, Mr. Walt pointed out that in Israel, there's more discussion and more criticism of Israeli policies than there is in the United States and also in Britain. So the American people are very much trapped in this Auschwitz of the mind, I would call it. An author named Glenn Stanish, who's written a book about 9/11, he's a professional pilot. Glenn Stanish wrote a book called Uncle Sam's Christian Patriots, and it has a lot. It's a very important book about 9/11 and the context that I write about, this Israeli role and the Israeli influence and Israeli evidence of Israeli involvement in 9/11. And in his book, Uncle Sam's Christian Patriots, he quotes Jim Garrison. And talking about how the United States media has created an Auschwitz of the mind. He says, Jim Garrison says, "We won't build Dachau's and Auschwitz's. The clever manipulation of the mass media is creating a concentration camp of the mind that promises to be far more effective in keeping the populace in line." And I highly recommend Glenn Stanish's book, Uncle Sam's Christian Patriots. He has a lot of material from my writing in there, my early writing about 9/11. His book came out a couple years ago. He was one of the pilots who was flying for American Airlines on September 11th, and he was furloughed for a couple years as a result of 9/11. And he spent his time well, his furlough time, his downtime well. He wrote a book about 9/11. Uncle Sam's Christian Patriots, and the book is available through Tate Publishing. That's T-A-T-E, publishing.com. They're out of Mustang, Oklahoma. And I highly recommend the book, but I do also recommend that if you're going to read Uncle Sam's Christian Patriots, that you put it on your bedside table and read it slowly and carefully from beginning to end. It's not the kind of a book that you drop in here and there, or read from the index first. This book you have to read slowly because Glenn Stanish is building his case, his spiritual, logical case about Israeli involvement. And it's a book that needs to be read carefully from beginning to end. I highly recommend it. Now, we're going to take a little break in a few minutes, and we'll come back, and I'll carry on with the widespread misconceptions of Israel and ignorance of Zionist history and Israeli crimes and terrorism, and why this history has to be understood by Americans if they want to understand what really happened on September 11th. So we'll take a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. So stay tuned. This is Christopher Bolin. Thank you. Bye-bye.